Good evening, you all. I'm Kilowatt 2, Kilowatt 2, Romeo, India Whiskey. Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee is Mel. Mel and Dick make an attempt to organize this enthusiastic crew of the New York City area that meets together each Sunday night to discuss their favorite subject, a little bit better understanding of ham radio, physics, science, astronomy, space, NASA, and whatever. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. After 28 years, we no longer require people to sign in to say they're listening. Right now, we assume somebody is listening. Otherwise, it wouldn't have lasted this long. We claim this is the new technical net where everybody gets some form of an answer during the first hour. And if the subject requires a little bit more in-depth answer, that takes place in the second and third hour, so to speak. At the end of the first hour, or just slightly before the end of the first hour, we go over to Mel's mailbag, in which the new people getting into ham radio send him questions because they don't have their license yet and they're in the process of getting a license. We're happy to find out that there's a significant number of people out there who, let me drop, by way of the a scanner or a friend or an internet or whatever, they find out about the technical net, listen to it, and decide that, gee, these guys doing ham radio are having a great lot of fun. I want to join them. I want to get an FCC license. And quite a few of those people will send emails to Mel, and most of the reasonable ones get answered. We got to be a little bit careful here. Mel and Dick are not offering a free consulting written service. It's a nice compliment, but we sometimes get people mailing us their college homework, their high school homework, their doctoral thesis, their master's thesis, things like this. That's not what we're volunteering for. That's a little bit beyond our the call of duty, if you know what I mean. Alrighty. If you've got a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW listening.
Yes, K2RIW, Richie, yes.
WJ2B, yes, with a question.
KZ2ZQJ, yes, with a question, Dave.
KZ2ZPM, calling, yes, with a question.
Okay, KZ2LTY,
yes.
Who was that last one that said yes?
Good evening, WA2RYY, yes.
Okay, we got you, Joe. The first one was KC2LTY, Rich, and there was a double in there. We're going to pick up that double in a minute. WJ2B was the next one. KC2ZTJ, I think it was Dave. KC2ZPM was the next one. ZPM, what is your name, sir?
I'm Colin, and I'm a freshman at Brooklyn Technical High School.
Are you KC2ZPM?
Yes.
And your name is?
Owen, KC2ZPM.
Okay, Owen, from Technical High School. Brooklyn Tech, I think it is. Is that the one on DeKalb Avenue?
Yes, it is.
I used to go to Pratt Institute, right down the street from you guys. Okay, so we've got the Rich, WJ2B, ZTJ, ZPM, RYY. Did I miss anybody?
Yes, K2KEY, former alumni.
There's a guy who went to Brooklyn Tech. He's got some good words to say about it. Okay, the first guy on the list was Rich, KC2 Lima Tango Yankee. Go right ahead, Rich, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Miss me, Dick, W2OSR.
We got you, Bob. Rich, LTY, go right ahead.
Okay, it's kind of like two parts to this question. In your opinion, at the moment, what is the disaster, the nuclear disaster in Japan, how bad could it get, and what is the possible impact to the United States?
Yeah, that one's a fairly fairly far left of center of normal ham radio subjects, Rich. I don't claim to be an expert in this one, but I do know that when you turn off a nuclear reactor, it doesn't turn itself off immediately. There's all kinds of other products it makes, radioactive products, and it takes them some number of days, weeks, months for them to cool down. So even though you turn a nuclear reactor off by reinserting its moderator rods, that's the scramming process, and that did take place at the beginning of the earthquake, from my understanding, you still have to continue to cool that core for a long period of time. And if you don't cool it, it goes to extremely high temperatures. Those high temperatures eventually threaten the zirconium coatings on the rods. Real high temperature steam touching those as they become exposed of the cooling water is capable of giving off hydrogen gas, which is explosive, and that's what did take place. And so the outer portions of the building got blown away on some of those reactors. I think the bottom line of all this is that a number of nuclear reactors, nuclear power stations, in a number of countries, people are going to give them a second, third, and fourth look to make sure that the safety procedures in place are sufficient. I mean, what happened in the case of Japan is that this is a once per 100-year or 200-year event, so to speak. A Richter 9 earthquake was way beyond the design capability. The seawall was beyond the design capability of the tsunami that succeeded, and as such, the standby generators got damaged. Lots and lots of things happened. Some venting of nuclear materials will take place. Maybe not a whole lot of dangerous nuclear materials are going to be vented to the environment, but some amount is going to take place.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Because insufficient cooling is taking place. Also, another big problem is that even after you've used those nuclear rods in your power station, at the end of their life, so to speak, you would like to send them back to a place where they get reprocessed and stored in a place like Yucca Flats in the United States. Well, for reasons I don't understand, we built the facility for storing radioactive material for long periods of time, but we're not going to be using it. So they get stored locally in the cooling pools, as they're called, in each reactor. And those rods in the cooling pools are building up all over the world, and they have to be continuously cooled. So in the case of these reactors in Japan, the spent rod cooling pools became exposed. Water wasn't being pumped into those. The main core was being exposed because not enough cooling water was being pumped into it. Very high temperatures took place. Partial meltdowns took place. And gases given off. Minor explosions took place. And some venting to the atmosphere. How long is it going to take to straighten this all out is a darn good question. I'd like to see anyone on frequency who has got more smarts on what's going on in Japan and wants to give us some words on that. Please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else besides Mel?
They fell asleep.
Go right ahead, Mel.
Come to asleep. Leave asleep, dogs.
A little more power if you can, Mel.
Give us his gay boyfriend.
Okay, well, there's a problem here, huh? Anyhow, one of the compounding problems, according to the AEC, is that they are using a mixture besides U-35. They're using another mixture called MOX, and this stuff makes it more deadly than the mixture of this extra material in this will make the meltdown will make it more contaminating, Dick, over here.
Yeah, the best I understand, Mel, is that only one of the four reactors that are in this trouble situation, only one of them are using MOX. I think the other three are not. But still, one is more than enough. And that's very worrisome. That whole situation is a little bit like Three Mile Island. It's going to take quite a significant period of time before you really find out what's going on. The local radiation is high enough, you can't put people in there for a very long period of time, so an awful lot of the analysis and repair is going to have to be done by robots. I think the bottom line is that some of the power industry in Japan is going to be hampered for a considerable period of time. Japan manufactures an awful lot of the components that are used in automobiles and a lot of the integrated circuits, a lot of the silicon that goes into the chips that we use. So some of these materials are going to go up in price, they're going to become more scarce, and secondary vendors are going to have to be found for building some of the things that were being built in Japan. So it's going to have a slight impact on the economy, as I see it, in a number of industries like the chip industry and automobile industry. Anyone else with any further comments on what's going on with the nuclear reactors in Japan? Give me your call letters right now.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KQLIW listening. Go ahead with your call letters.
KC2RFM.
KC2WGB.
Alan and John in that order. Go ahead, Alan.
Stop you!
As far as the impact on the United States, I had read that there are detectable levels as far as Nevada, but that those levels are not a hazard. And before everybody gets a little too crazy over all of this, let's not forget that we all live in background radiation. If you're in a room with sheetrock walls, you're always being exposed to a little bit of radiation. We've done radiation tests in the past. We've blown off bombs in the atmosphere in the past. In of itself, it's not something to worry about and think it's going to be life-threatening. And I hope that it doesn't start a panic and a general distrust for nuclear power and all things nuclear. It was a mistake, you know, due to an act of God, and that's it. You know, it's not everything's going to work perfect, but up until that, and Three Mile Island, the nuclear energy has a very good reputation. So I just hope people don't go off half-cocked and start running like the villagers with torches, you know, storming nuclear power plants. Back in the
WJTB recovery.
Okay, Joe recognized after John. Yeah, you got a good point there, Alan, that the fact that something is detectable doesn't mean that it is dangerous. There are certain pharmaceuticals and chemicals and whatever that we can measure in parts per million, parts per billion, and sometimes parts per trillion. And so what is the dangerous level? You got to look at that. So the fact that we can detect tiny amounts of nuclear radiation slightly above background in portions of the United States is not yet a thing to be alarmed about. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Mel. Dick, I just want to remind you, they are using the nuclear storage facilities in Yucca Mountain and that area out there, but the problem is the rods have to stay so long before they are transportable through the nation's little cities. They're usually done by trucks, but that's the only thing that delays them. They do use the storage facilities. I just wanted to mention that. Back to Ned.
Glad to hear that, John. I thought they were not using Yucca Mountain at all for future materials. So I guess you're saying they wait till the stuff cools down somewhat and getting ready for transport. Joe, WJ2B, go right ahead.
WS2N, I heard there's a hole on Yucca.
I hear you, Paul. Joe, go right ahead.
Okay, WJ2B, I just wanted to add that the Geiger counter sales on eBay are tremendously impacted by that thing that happened in Japan. There's you know, those old civil defense, those yellow Geiger counters that are like 40 years old, like a CDV 700. They used to go for about $30-$35. I've seen them selling for $200 to $300 on eBay now. Everybody is wanting a Geiger counter to check their radiation levels. Back over here to WJTV.
Yeah, the so-called Geiger Mullen tube, the old-fashioned Geiger counter, by modern standards is not very sensitive. Scintillation counters, the more modern type machine, is a hell of a lot more sensitive, if I understand correctly. So, we're far from experts on the subject, and this situation is going to be in the news for a long time to come, as I see it, Rich. KC2LTY for any further comments. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No extra questions. I appreciate the comments. Thank you.
Okay, Rich. Joe, you're next. What's going on in Wisconsin? WJ2B, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. Hello to everybody in the TechNet. WJ2B here. I have a question that is sort of an offshoot of Doppler theory regarding the antennas that people designed for Doppler radio direction finding equipment. And my question has to do with how does a quarter wave whip antenna placed in... terminated with an open circuit. Expert on Doppler. Way for the off state whips not to interfere with the wave. Best way for yes, they have a what is the best with the wave for
okay, I was hearing Joe on the input. And he's really asking the questions of what's the best way to terminate the unused antennas of a Doppler scanner. The way Doppler shift works, just a couple of quick words in the background, is that if a source of a signal is approaching you, you could say the waves get compressed and you hear a higher frequency wave. You know that an automobile or a railroad train approaching you, you get a higher pitch. You get normal pitch as it passes by you at right angles, and then you hear a lower pitch when it's moving away from you. So that's the Doppler effect. It's named after a human being who actually discovered this phenomenon. And so if you could move the antenna at very high velocities around a circular pattern, then as the antenna, say for instance the signal is coming from the north, and you've got an antenna on a turntable that's flat to the earth, and you're moving the antenna very rapidly, as the antenna is moving, we'll say, clockwise, as the antenna is at the 9 o'clock position, it's moving closer toward the north, therefore it sees a higher frequency. As the antenna passes the 12 o'clock position, it's moving at right angles, it sees normal frequency. As the antenna is at the 3 o'clock position on this turntable, it's moving away from the emitter to the north, and it sees a lower frequency. So if you could move the antenna rapidly enough, you would see this cyclic frequency shift. You'd see an increasing and decreasing frequency in a sine wave manner as the antenna was moving around the perimeter of this very rapidly turning turntable. Well, you'd have to turn the turntable at rates that are beyond the speed of sound to get enough Doppler shift at radio frequencies. So you can't do that physically, but you do it electronically. You can set an antenna at the 12 o'clock position, the 3 o'clock position, the 6 o'clock position, and the 9 o'clock position. Electronically, you can switch to those antennas and...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Electronically, you can switch to those antennas in microseconds or nanoseconds so that you can, by electronic switching, you can be doing the equivalent of moving the antenna. And you get almost the same performance, or at least something very close. However, when you're switching to the 3 o'clock antenna, you want no response to take place at the other three antennas. And if they were terminated in 50 ohms, you would get one kind of response. If they were terminated in a short circuit, you'd get another kind of response. If they're terminated with an open circuit, another kind of response. What we're trying to do is shift the apparent phase center of the active antenna. That's what you're really trying to do. You would like the antenna at 3 o'clock to be active, and all other antennas create no real effect on this Doppler shifting performance procedure that you're going through. Let me drop. By the laws of conservation of energy, any signal hitting the antennas, if you want the 3 o'clock antenna to be active, any signal hitting the 12 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and 6 o'clock antennas, if they were terminated with a short circuit or an open circuit, those antennas would be absorbing some signal and re-reflecting it. And when they re-reflect it, it creates a difference in the performance of the 3 o'clock antenna. Its apparent phase center will shift, its impedance will shift, funny things will happen. So therefore, as I see it, a short circuit would give you a complete reflection from the inactive antennas, and the short circuit gives you one other phenomena, not only complete reflection, but a phase shift. An open circuit gives you a complete reflection without a phase shift. A 50-ohm termination gives you essentially complete absorption. So, as I see it, the Cadillac approach would be that all of the inactive antennas would be terminated with a 50-ohm resistor. Therefore, all signals absorbed by the inactive antennas goes down to the 50-ohm load, gets absorbed, and no further reflection takes place. I believe that's the best. I'm not saying that short circuits and open circuits will not work. I'm just saying that they are going to be creating another effect that has to be accounted for, reflected signals. And those reflected signals are going to give you some peculiar performances that you maybe can compensate for. I don't know. I don't think I remember reading any articles on how people have compensated for short or open circuited inactive antennas on a Doppler shift system. Let me drop. And the real study of what's going on here, it's time somebody do it. To terminate the unused antenna with a 50-ohm resistor means that the switching networks at each of the antennas now has to be a single pole, double throw, where you either throw it to, it takes a more complicated switching network to terminate the unused antennas with an inactive 50-ohm termination resistor. To simply terminate them with a short circuit or an open circuit by putting pin diode or other kinds of switching devices, electronic switching devices, is the easiest way. But then you're going to have to do a study as to where is the real phase center. I have, on occasion, measured the apparent phase center of antenna networks that have electronic switching. And it's not an easy procedure. It's not an easy procedure to describe how to do it. But it's something else that has to be taken into account. So as I see it, Joe, 50-ohm termination, if you can do it, is the best. I'm not saying the other approaches are not going to work, but if you really want accuracy, you're going to have to do some other kind of compensation with the more simple networks. I know that KC2QIQ went through some of these procedures. If Glenn is available, he can tell us what he did to accommodate for this. When I saw his schematic diagrams in the second to latest issue of the Limoc log, I believe he simply did not terminate the unused resistor. Let's find out if Glenn is available. KC2QIQ, are you on frequency? K2LIW in the TechNet. Yeah, maybe Glenn's not available. So he's one of the people who have done more serious experimentation with Doppler scanner systems. And when he made improvements on the antennas, the switching network, and whatever, and installed it on his automobile, and he made a more elaborate network than just simple mag mounts on the car, he got considerable improvement in performance. So when we get a chance to talk to Glenn, and maybe he'll sign in later, I think we'll find out more information. Anyone else who has done some serious work with Doppler scanner systems and has been through this antenna terminating problem, if you got any further information, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2OSR, this touches on what I was going to talk about, Dick.
Okay, yep. Let's pick you up, Bob. Where do you stand with your Doppler scanner? And have you, I'm guessing you also worried about how you terminate the unused resistor, unused antennas. And losing some sleep over it, what have you discovered so far, Bob? W2OSR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I built something which you could probably describe as a 2-meter, 4-square antenna. It consists of 4 vertical 2-meter antennas. When I modeled it with the EasyNeck, I tried it with the center of the unused antennas open and with a 50-ohm load in the center and shorted. Open, those 4 antennas really had no effect on anything. With the 50-ohm load, you saw directionality of the antenna system with a forward gain, according to EasyNeck, of about 9 dB. With those antennas, those 3 unused antennas shorted, your forward directivity went up to almost 11 dB, according to EasyNet.
Where the question comes in, that people disagree on that.
Yeah, part of what's going on here is that depending on how you terminate or don't terminate the unused antennas, you will get a shift in pattern. The shift in pattern could give you a certain front-to-back ratio in gain, and that alone does not give you the full Doppelscan of phenomena. In other words, if I could take something like a Yagi antenna and rotate it very rapidly, and I've got a real good design Yagi antenna, it's got a real good front-to-back ratio, if I could see the antenna pattern in three-dimensional space, it would be a great big cucumber, so to speak, with a nice big forward lobe and no back lobes. And if I could sweep that antenna very rapidly in azimuth, I could do direction finding with that, but there's a catch. That would be an amplitude-sensitive direction finding system, because as I rotate that antenna around its center, I would be not getting a phase shift, I'd only be getting an amplitude shift. So studying the antenna pattern and the gain of an antenna in these various configurations doesn't necessarily settle the problem. The way the Doppelscanners work in an FM system, because you've always got a limiter discriminator, let me drop. Because your final detector has a limiter which takes out any amplitude modulation, therefore any change in the pattern alone is not enough. The way the Doppelscanner works is that it wants to see a shift in phase, or you could call it a shift in frequency. You have to take the apparent phase center of emission if the antenna was transmitting. And by the way, because of reciprocity, however an antenna network operates when it's transmitting should be identical to the way it operates when it's receiving. Quite often, in order to explain what's going on with phase-shifting antennas, it's easier to explain what goes on in the transmitting mode and then flip over to receiving thinking, if you know what I mean, in that way. So you want the apparent center of emission of the signal, if you were transmitting, to literally move from the 12 o'clock position to the 3 o'clock position to the 6 o'clock position to the 9 o'clock position in a known sequence of time. You want the apparent phase center to shift, and as such you get the phase shift of signal or frequency shift of signal that the discriminator will respond to. So just making the amplitude pattern change is not enough. You have to shift the electronic phase center. So I didn't say it's easy, but you got to go one step deeper into the way the thing works. Now, if in the process of shifting the antenna pattern and shifting the gain, if the apparent phase center is also moving in a known way, then you can make the Doppelscanner work again with those simulations that you've done. So many of these modeling programs, unless you ask the question just right, they're not telling you where the apparent phase center of emission is taking place. They're only telling you antenna pattern and impedances. I wonder if that makes a little more sense about W2OSR, one of our directors, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I follow exactly what you're saying, Dick, and that was one of my concerns when I designed the antenna. The next step is we're going to hook it up to a Doppler receiving system and see what happens. I know I built one antenna, which was according to some design stuff that somebody had given me, and then I decided to go off on my own when I saw what the possibilities were of getting more performance out of the antenna system. Now, the question is, with the spacings that I have, is that going to throw the Doppler aspect of the antenna off into left field and not work at all?
Yeah, one possible approach, as I see it, Bob, is to simply hook it up to a good known Doppler scanner and see how it works. However, if everything was perfect in what's going on with the antenna, and if everything was working correctly in the rest of the Doppler scanning back-end processing system, then as you drive your automobile in circles in a great big parking lot, you'll see the signal will go around the perimeter of the display device for your Doppler scanner, and everything's hunky-dory. So if everything is right, you get a beautiful answer. If there's an error anywhere in the electronics, in the back-end processing, in the overload characteristics and the switching transients that go into the receiver, if there's anything in error with the antenna, now you get results that are crazy. And so if everything is perfect, you get a good answer. If anything the chain is no stronger than the weaker link, weakest link. If anything is not working correctly in that total system, you get an answer that's crazy and you don't know where to go next. I think we've got to do a divide and conquer here. Let me drop.
Dick, I got to go. W2OSY.
Okay, Bob's got to drop out, but I'll keep talking to Joe, who asked the original question. The next step of what we've got to do is a divide and conquer, and that is to really know whether or not your antenna system is doing the job correctly. It is my belief that if you're a real scientist, you're going to measure apparent phase center. How do you do that? You set up the Doppelscanner antennas on top of the automobile, and you switch one at a time. In other words, you switch to the 12 o'clock antenna, then the 3 o'clock antenna, then the 6 o'clock antenna, and the 9 o'clock antenna. And with a vector network analyzer on an antenna that's placed to the north of the automobile, you measure what happened to the apparent phase center. In other words, by way of a vector network analyzer or similar instrumentation you could set up, you find out when you go from the 12 o'clock position to the 3 o'clock position, you know that the 3 o'clock antenna, if you're doing the measurement to the north, you know that the 3 o'clock antenna is, let me pick a number, half a wavelength further away from you. And therefore you should see with half a wavelength 180 degrees of phase shift of the signal that you get when you switch from the 12 o'clock antenna to the 3 o'clock antenna. That sounds complicated, not quite as bad as you think. So to actually make the measurement, to really confirm that this portion of the system is doing what you want, is doable. And I recommend you do that if you want an accurate Doppelscanner system. I didn't say you can't make it work without doing this, but at least you can now check off this particular unknown item. Is the antenna doing what you want it to do? And then you start worrying about whether or not the switching transients are overloading the receiver and going into its recovery time, and whether or not you're getting transients and the processing that goes on in the back end of the system, so that it does give you the correct direction of arrival of signals. So, Doppelscanner systems that show...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A Doppelscanner system is not for the faint of heart. It's not a beginner project. This is a fairly deep project if you really want it to be well understood and work well. But step by step, once you know where the minefield is, there are ways of handling the situation. And so by asking these questions, by doing these tests, by us sharing information as we do this kind of testing, we all will come up with better systems. I know that Ramsey, among other companies, have sold Doppelscanner kits. And various people putting those together have had mixed results, sometimes medium good, sometimes not so good. And so each of these individual ingredients that are required for a good Doppelscanner system are something that once you know what you're looking for, setting up a ham radio qualified instrumentation could be done to confirm it. A really smart ham can use very simple equipment to make very simple testing procedures. Maybe that helps a little bit, Joe. WJ2B, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2T, Y coming.
Go ahead, Mel.
Well, this is K2KEY. Well, a good way to get the demonstration of how old Doppler antenna is working is to pick up one of the satellites, one of the amateur radio satellites, such as AO40. And you can hear as the satellite's coming towards you or, you know, away from you, the difference in the Doppler. It's a very good static way of, you know, stay in one place and still getting how an idea of how your antenna is performing, Dick. Over.
There's a yes and a no to that one, Mel. If the particular satellite I'm listening to on this particular pass comes up from my southern horizon, passes straight overhead, and then goes to my northern horizon, and I aim my antenna to the south as I get acquisition of signal, and I know exactly what frequency the satellite is on, and I tune my receiver, my well-calibrated receiver, I'll have to tune the receiver to a higher frequency as it comes over my southern horizon and the satellite is coming toward me. As the satellite is straight overhead and I aim my antenna straight up, I'll find out that it's right on the right frequency. As the satellite goes over my northern horizon, in my example, I'll notice that I get a QSY, so to speak. The signal starts going to a lower frequency with my BFO, with my upper sideband reception technique of the receiver. I'll notice that I've got to tune the receiver to a lower frequency in order to zero beat it again. there, by that procedure, using the satellite, I am confirming the Doppler effect. That doesn't tell me that my Doppler scanner antenna is working correctly. To use a satellite as a method of confirming the Doppler scanner receiver is a very difficult way to go for reasons that those signals themselves are so darn weak. Most satellites, I can easily hear the signal with a good set of earphones and a sideband mode of the receiver and maybe a narrowband resolution bandwidth, but to get enough signal to capture the limiter to work the Doppler scanner, I don't think so. So that test proves the Doppler phenomena, doesn't prove to me that my Doppler scanner system is working correctly. That's my belief on that one. Wonder if some of this makes some more sense, Joe. WJ2B, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And to exchange comment?
Joe first, and then Wesley in that order. Go ahead, Joe.
WJ2B. I tend to agree with the 50 ohm not affecting the wavefront, that the signal is absorbed by the antenna and not re-radiated, because the Cadillac of Doppler scanners is basically the Doppler systems unit, and the designer, owner of Doppler systems, I've been in touch with him, and he's told me that the 50 ohm termination gives the best accuracy and best performance. Basically, what they do is they go into an amplifier, you know, they terminate the antenna, you know, add a controlled 50 ohm impedance into a wideband amplifier, and then do the switching on the output. It's actually not switching, it's resistive PID diode, resistive attenuation at the output of the amplifier, and they do a soft switching where they actually, you know, they blend the outputs of each of the amplifiers together, very, you know, complicated with a, you know, it's an A to, I believe it's a D to A converter, controls the waveform going to the pin diodes, and they, that's the Cadillac Doppler there. But the fast switch type Dopplers, the people that design those, the Ramsey and the guys in California, they basically use a off, they want the antennas to be in the off mode, completely open circuit when they, you know, when they have the off mode antennas. So that seems to be the cheapest method and the best working, the Ramsey, and those seem to work okay. You know, not as good as the Doppler systems, but the Doppler systems do a 50 ohm control impedance on the off antenna. So back over to you, Dick, WJ2D.
Yeah, I agree with you, Joe. The Cadillac approach is 50 ohm termination of unused antennas. With enough testing and understanding of what's going on, and maybe computer modeling, you could quite possibly, with short circuits or open circuits of the unused antennas, make the system work again. But it's going to require a different kind of calibration, a different setup, in my opinion. You're still going to be getting a phase shift of the apparent center of radiation as you do the switching. However, it's not going to be quite as pure. It's going to require other compensation. So I think it can be done, but there's more to it that first meets the eye, as you can tell. Wesley, I wonder if you've decided you're going to build a Doppler scanner system. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. No, I don't have time for it, but I've got a quite significant library of whatever is available in the market, and I would like to share it with you, guys. And one of them, apart from Ramsey, is W6DFW. I'll repeat again for somebody who wants to make a note. W6DFW. And the company is called Bionics, B-Y-O-N-I-C-S. The number of six or seven different applications for antenna Doppler. The other one is to be blamed for very sophisticated, very nice system is VE2EMM. I'm going to drop. VE2EMM, and the model number of the device is being called Montreal Doppler 3V2. Again, Montreal Doppler 3V2. What is good about this one is that it is a computer controlled. So it's a computer-based Doppler with DF unit for FM receivers. Now the other one, let me drop, is WB2HOL. And this one is responsible for a typical tape measure beams. It's not a Doppler. It's just for somebody who wants to have something very much portable. Now for those who wants to use a thing that is Alpha Radio LTD makes a good rotators that will give you azimuth and elevation. And actually, Alpha is Polish base. I mean, they are in Canada, but in Alberta, but they are Polish guys. Then another one, very sophisticated Doppler system, LLC. Doppler Systems, LLC, Radio Direction Finding Systems. Absolutely amazing one. Frequencies between 100 and 1000 megahertz. So, if somebody wants to take a ride for the cockroaches, I'm sorry. It's this is not the biology session. Another one is the Argerlo Engineering DFJ Doppler Direction Finder. And this is from Amateur Radio Today magazine of 1997 issue. The AGRELO Engineering DFJ Doppler Direction Finder. I was reading a little bit about it. And the person to be blamed for is K0OV.
Oh, it well.
Yeah, K0OV is the guy from California. Fulltron, I'm sorry, Pulletron, California. And the webpage is www.homingin.com. Very nice one, ready to use, made on a car. And to examine.
Yeah, looks like we've got quite a few different places there where we can get further Doppler information. Whiskey Bravo 2 Hotel Oscar Lima, Whiskey 6 Delta Foxtrot Whiskey, Bionics, Victor Echo 2 Echo Mike Mike. Looks like there's a lot of them there. Did I also hear Ed in the background? Was that you, Ed? Or somebody said they had further comments. So it looks like there's a lot of ways we can look up Doppler information, Doppler scanner information. But once you've got a system that you've either bought, built, borrowed, or whatever, bought on eBay, there are ways you can test the antenna section, the amplifier section. It's all got to, it's got to be married correctly. In other words, the antenna has to shift its apparent phase center of radiation as you do the electronic switching of the four or six or whatever number of antennas. The switching itself, the electronic switching, has to have the right kind of a waveform, which doesn't make a switching transient that overloads the receiver, where the receiver now has to go into recovery time on each individual switching. And if you've got a receiver that's spending all of its time doing recovery, it's going to have terrible sensitivity. So you have to have a good antenna, the right kind of a waveform of switching, the right kind of bandwidth, the right kind of filtering, and the right kind of back-end processing, so for everything to work right. And by divide and conquer, you can test each one of those components of your system and eventually find out what's going on and making it work. Once you know what's required, you know what to look for, if you know what I mean. So I can tell that these groups that are within the sound of my voice are going to be Doppler scanning production and testing procedures for some time to come. That's a valuable tool once you've got it, and there are times when we really need that tool. Good luck with that project, Joe, and come back periodically and let us know how it goes. Let me drop for a minute.
KC2, QIQ.
Hey, Glenn, you're the guy that we're looking for. You've done it. The earliest question was, how did you properly terminate the unused antennas of the Doppler scanner? The Cadillac approach is to terminate them with 50 ohms. If you open circuit or short circuit them, you're getting a reflected antenna, which might require other compensation in order to make the Doppler switching system work correctly. wonder how, when I looked at your schematic diagram that you published in the Limock log, I think you went to simple diode switching where you open circuited the unused antennas. And if the reflection off of them was small enough, the perturbation that that creates is fairly small, and I think the system can still work. I wonder how you got around that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody else on the net tonight. I experimented with actually all three, you know, shorting the antenna, opening it, and, you know, trying to, you know, bias the switching diodes, because I'm using a Ramsey at present right now, and, you know, try to just, you know, bias it with a resistor, something close to 50 ohms. And the best approach that I had was going to the original termination that that Ramsey had, where I put a shunt inductor actually right across the antenna, and that's I believe it's about like 1.2 or 1.3 millihenries, and I drive the currents through the diodes to turn them on, and then when the signal drops, it basically puts the diode switches into an open. But I guess to RF, that's not a very, very good match on the antenna. It's neither a short, neither an open, or 50 ohms. It's something in between, but that seems to work best with that particular system, Dick.
Yeah, 1.3 millihenry is something like 1,000 ohms of inductive reactance at 144 megacycles. As such, that's essentially an open circuit. So the 1.3 millihenry allows you to define the DC value at that point in the circuit, and therefore you know what you're doing when it comes to biasing the diodes. So if I understand you correctly then, Glenn, you simply went to open circuit. Whatever reflection you got from the antenna was apparently not detrimental to the Doppler shifting function. You still were getting the correct shift of the apparent phase center, is what I think you're saying. Is that one interpretation, Glenn? Go ahead.
I'd say that's pretty accurate, Dick. As a matter of fact, most of the electronics in the Ramsey system, I didn't really find any particular problems with. I mean, in general, the circuit itself was pretty well thought out, and most of the other experiments I tried to improve the circuit, other than maybe using some better diodes, improved surface mount diodes and getting rid of some of the lead length and shielding and that sort of thing, improved the system quite a bit. But the general circuit philosophy, I think, is good enough. Certainly more than good enough to do transmitter hunting from an automobile.
Yeah, Doppler scanning is so darn important that we dwelled a little bit extra time. We dwelled longer than we should have by our premise. So I'm going to leave you for now, Joe, but please come back periodically and let us know how the project goes. I better go over to KC2, I think it was Zebra Tango Juliet. He said his name was Dave, but the QRZ said his name should be Andy. KC2ZTJ, I may have your call letters wrong. K2LAW, go ahead, sir.
Good evening, Dick. Thanks for taking my question. His name is Dave, KC2ZQJ. Just put up a new electrical dipole antenna, and I'm looking for an alternate way of checking the resonance without using just an antenna tuner here to trick my radio into thinking that it's got a wonderful SWR without having to go and purchase another $200 or $300 or $400 piece of equipment. And that's my question. Thank you.
Yeah, the exact frequency where your dipole gives the best performance could be academic, as I see it, Dave. If you can measure standing wave ratio, in other words, if you can apply 100 watts to the antenna and hopefully get 3 watts coming back from the antenna as far as the transmission line and the shack is concerned, that's a beautiful match. And who cares if you're using the antenna at 14.2 megacycles and you get a very low VISWR, who cares if the antenna was resonant at 13.99 and you're using it at 14.2? If the VISWR is low enough at your particular frequency of operation, then the antenna is more than good enough. Most of our no-tune radios these days, our solid-state trinals, want to see something better than about 1.7 or so standing wave ratio. And as long as you're better than 1.7, everything's hunky-dory. Everything that beyond that is kind of academic. You're not going to make any significant improvement in the gain, signal strength, or whatever when you tune it better than that. Do it if you want to, but you don't have to. So measuring the exact resonant frequency, a little bit academic, but borrowing somebody's bird wattmeter or any other kind of VizWatt measuring equipment. In fact, on many of an antenna tuner, there is some kind of an output network there that will tell you what is the reflected power ratio, or how many watts is going forward versus how many watts is coming back. So that's all you really have to know from my point of view, Dave. KC2ZQJ, K2RIW in the tech pan.
Okay, does that also apply when it's a multi-band antenna? This has got 80 through 10 meters. So I was wondering, does that same principle, what you just discussed, apply in that case as well?
Yes, it does, Dave. If it's an 80 through 10 meter antenna, and if I'm going to be using it at 3.75 megs on 80 meters and 7.42 megs on 40 meters and so on, what is the standing wave ratio that the antenna gives me on each one of those bands on my favorite frequency? That's the first thing you want to know about. And if the VizWatt you get on each one of your favorite frequencies is less than, let me pick a number, 1.7 to 1 standing wave ratio, then you're home free and everything's hunky-dory. The fact that it's a multi-band antenna doesn't matter per se. If you find out that one of those frequencies gives you, let me pick a number, a 2.5 standing wave ratio, where your transmitter is now going to go into a self-protect mode, where it either puts out less power or turns its final stage off or whatever, now you're going to want to do some further investigation. If, for instance, you see that at the at 7.48 megacycles, it gives you a high VizWatt, now you want to know by tuning it to 7.45, 7.40, 7. I'm getting the frequencies wrong here, but you know what I mean. Scan it across the band and measure the VizWatt at each one of those frequencies, you'll eventually draw out a bathtub-shaped curve of standing wave ratio versus frequency from which you can say, hey, on that band is tuned high, then that particular resonator, I want to change it accordingly. So that's the next step. But your basic piece of test equipment is whatever can measure standing wave ratio at your particular power level or lower than your power level. You can always cut back the power of the transmitter to measure the VizWatt if your instrument can only tolerate lower amounts of power. So as I see it, measuring VizWatt first at your frequencies and then if you're in trouble at the adjacent frequencies will tell you most of what you want to know. And in most cases, that's not a very expensive piece of equipment. Over to you, Dave. KC2ZQJ, K2RIW.
KB2HZE, check again to the net.
KC2FFA, checking in to the net.
N2MB, checking into the net. Good evening.
Okay. Don't know if you're going to be able to handle you guys in the first hour, but I wonder if that all made sense to you, Dave, go ahead.
Makes sense, and you saved me a few hundred dollars tonight, so I'm going to try that first. Thank you very much again.
Okay, the very next person who signed in was KC2 Zebra Papa Mike. I don't know if I got your name. Please give me your name and go ahead with your question. K2RIW on the TechNet.
My name is Colin. Over.
Go right ahead, Colin.
I'm working on building a VFO for the 20-meter band using direct digital synthesis, and I'm using the AD9835 chip, and I was wondering if I should smooth the output of it or how I should filter it. Over.
Okay, the VFO you're building for the 20-meter band, are you following somebody else's schematic diagram? Are you using the data sheet that came with that chip? How are you going about this, Colin? Go ahead.
I'm using the data sheet. Over.
Okay, the data sheet that you're using, that chip tells you that it's an oscillator and it's a variable frequency oscillator. Does the data sheet say that it's intended for ham radio operation? Does the data sheet tell you what harmonics it puts out? One of the things you got to worry about is what frequency stability does it give you and whether or not it's putting out the second harmonic and third harmonic and how many dB down, because depending on the way the rest of your transmitter is working, you do worry about whether or not you're putting out a second harmonic. In theory, the FCC wants your second harmonic to be suppressed by, I think it's 60 decibels in order to be legal. So that might require a low-pass filter to make sure you meet that requirement. However, the way your next stage of your transmitter gets tuned and the way the final amplifier gets tuned, those are automatically bandpass filters. And maybe the bottom line is you don't have to worry about the harmonics coming out of the voltage, the variable frequency oscillator. What you really care about is what harmonics go to the antenna. Unfortunately, to really measure the harmonic power going to the antenna does require a little bit more expensive instrumentation, like using a spectrum analyzer. I think you see where I'm going on this one, Colin. KC2ZPM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2ZPM. The data sheet says it has the second harmonic is 60 decibels down and it has a 50 to 1 signal to noise ratio, over.
And if the data sheet is telling you the truth, and if you're building it exactly like the data sheet tells you to lay it out, sounds to me like you're home free, Colin. Over to you.
So I should just use a low-pass filter on the output?
If you want to be belt and suspenders, the answer is yes. But since that oscillator is very rarely, unless you're running real QRP, very low power, very rarely does a person take a VFO and connect it directly to the antenna. Most likely you're going to be going through other transmitting stages. Well, those other transmitting stages of your preamplifier and your amplifier and your final stage of the transmitter, they all are tuned stages. Each one of them will be giving you some amount of rejection of harmonics from the oscillator. You got to worry a little bit about whether or not those stages themselves are making some harmonics, but those tuned stages could be all the filtering you need. If you have doubt, if you finish this whole network and you sample the signal as it goes to the transmission line, that's the way to find out what your harmonics really are. And the strongest harmonics might be coming from the final amplifier stage itself, not from the VFO, at all, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Colin, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was planning on connecting it just with an amplifier to the antenna and using it for radio teletype, over.
Sounds like you've got it made. Sounds like you've got a nice data sheet. You're laying it out correctly, putting in a nice shielded box with the right kind of bypass capacitors, a good clean power supply to make sure there's no hum on it, and I think it should work like a charm. As you do further testing and building of that thing, come back periodically and let us know how it's working, Colin. Other people would probably like to follow your project. The next person who signed in was Joe, W-H-U-R-Y-Y. Go right ahead, Joe, K2RIW and TechNet. Haven't heard from you in a while.
Good evening, Dick. How you doing? I had a simple question. I guess you love simple questions on the TechNet.
We're all ears, Joe.
Okay. I've wondered about this for a while. I probably may have known the answer at one time. I just can't recall it right now. But basically, what causes an RF amplifier to go down in efficiency as you go higher in frequency? For example, comparing something operating at 30 megs, 150 megs, 450, 800, and so forth. As you go up and up and up in frequency, the efficiency seems to go down. What process is going on here?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of processes going on there, Joe. In the case of old-fashioned tube circuits, if I took a 4CX150 tube and I tested its efficiency at 6 meters, 2 meters, 450, and the maximum frequency of operation for the tube is rated at 500 megs, and if I tried using it at 1296, instead of getting hundreds of watts of output, I'd be happy to get tens of watts of output. In the case of a tube, transit time loading is the problem. In other words, as the frequency gets higher and higher, the spacing between the cathode and the plate starts becoming a bigger and bigger fraction of a wavelength. Those electrons leaving the cathode don't get a chance to get through the grid and get all the way to the plate on each half cycle before the cycle is over with. So transit time loading in the case of a vacuum tube is one of the major factors by which gain falls off and efficiency falls off as you go to higher frequencies. In the case of solid-state devices, there's the equivalent. Each transistor has a maximum frequency of operation, so there is the equivalent of transit time loading. In other words, in your NPN transistor. It takes a certain length of time, certain number of picoseconds, for those electrons leaving it's not cathode anymore, what is it, source, drain, collector, you know what I mean, but leaving the input section and getting to the output section, it takes a certain length of time. That's one of the factors. Another factor is the silicon itself. It's got a certain amount of loss of tangent. In other words, as you go to higher frequencies, let me drop.